So the reading for today is from Hebrews 6, 16 to 20. People swear by someone greater than themselves, and the oath confirms what is said and puts an end to all argument. Because God wanted to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed it with an oath. God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope set before us may be greatly encouraged. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where our forerunner, Jesus, has entered on our behalf. He has become a high priest forever in the order of the Melchizedek. Thank you.
Thanks. Joe got a clap for the Bible reading. That's pretty good. Doesn't always happen. So I'm going to start tonight with a very Christian word that used to freak me out in Bible college. It's called eschatological. Hands up if you know what eschatological means. Oh, yes. Who? Tell me. Birdie. Yes. End times, yes. What? Yes, no, you're right. The end times. Eschatological. It means peering into the things of the end, into the future events of what we believe as Christians. Here's a quote by William Willimon. The Christian faith is eschatological, always leaning into the future, standing on tiptoes, eager to see what God is bringing to birth among us. That's what we're doing tonight. We're peering into the end things, getting a glimpse into it as God's eschatological people. We are the kind of people who are constantly gazing through the current moment, through the now, past that, into the horizon to see what is coming, what God is bringing forth in the future. We're like the original Luke Skywalkers who are standing, looking at the horizon, gazing past what's going on tiptoes, eager to see what's happening next, discontent with the way things are and eager for the future. That's actually from A New Hope, which is the title of this sermon tonight as well. So there you go. Well done. So God's people being eschatological and having this radical posture of like on their tiptoes looking to what is going to come to pass, that's actually not how the average person thinks of Christians. Usually they think of Christians as being people of the past who are just kind of a tragic bunch of people trying to safeguard old religion and old forms of doing things like archaic liturgical practices and the way things have been done in the church and trying to recycle what's happened before in a desperate attempt to cling onto power maybe or some sense of meaning and purpose in a very scary world. Maybe that's how people see Christians, as people of the past. But we're people of the future. If you were to get a pair of scissors, and open up the Bible, go to the New Testament, and cut out any reference to the resurrection, to the return of Jesus, to our resurrection, to the renewal of all things, the new heavens and the new earth, you'd lose up to three quarters of the New Testament. Because we are the people of the future. We are the people of hope, is another way to say it. Which is important because every person on the planet is wired for hope. Everything that is ever done is done by hope. John Calvin said that. We start businesses in the hope that they're going to return some sort of profit. We study to get into, with the hope of getting into some sort of degree that will then lead into a pathway where we're going to get a good career. We start a relationship, the hope that we're going to get some sort of mutual satisfaction and intimacy. And we go to marriage courses sometimes because we hope that something that has been broken might be repaired. Everything we do as human beings is done by hope. And we're the people of hope. We are the people of hope, people of the future, the eschatological people. But the problem with hope, it's an obvious one, is that you always risk, if you hope into something, you always risk being thoroughly disappointed. Just that feeling of like, ugh, I dropped my ice cream, like, ugh. I see it all the time, my daughter Primrose, because the poor little thing is gluten and dairy intolerant. So you can imagine what it's like at every single birthday party she ever goes to. She's always like, Daddy, can I have the cake this time? It's always like, sorry, sweetie. It's got dairy in it. Constant. And the disappointment on her face, it's like the first time she's ever had that realization every time we go to a party. Utter disappointment. We know what that's like. There's always this sense of, I've invested so much of my hope into that. I had hoped that business would work. I had hoped that my children would actually come to faith. I had hoped that I would get into that course. I'd hoped that I'd get past the first round of applicants in that job. I had hoped that my marriage would have survived. These are real hopes and real disappointments. And if disappointments occur enough and frequently enough, and if they're heavy enough, disappointment leads to despair. And we know the statistics at the moment of the radical kind of deep despair that is going on in so many chunks of our just Australian society. But for most of us, it's just plain old disappointment. And when Christians kind of get affected by disappointment, particularly disappointment in God, then it's like a wet blanket is thrown over us, thrown over the fire of our hope. And we stop being the people of the future who are looking ahead and just like so certain about what God's going to do. And we become the people of the past. We really do. Who are just hell-bent on safeguarding tradition. And like we talked about last week, are fueled by something that God has done all the way back then. Or we get stuck in the now. We become fixated on today and today's worries, and we can't see past that. We're just trying to survive. So at the end of the day, I mean, I feel like this all the time. It's like another glass of wine to just like, to just numb out the feeling that you're just surviving. Or binging another show because it's just about the now. Like there's no forward focus. That's what happens when disappointments come upon a Christian often enough. It's a wet blanket. But I don't want to be like that. I want to know how to become the kind of person, the kind of Christian who is leaning into the future on tiptoes, eager for what God is going to do, and to just believe it through and through and to have it impact my current moment in life. But to do that, for any of us to do that, we need to realize that what we actually hope for as Christians is the only thing that will not disappoint. The only thing. In a world full of constant disappointments, this is the only thing that will not disappoint. Really? It's hard to wrestle through, but it's true. Paul who knew very much what it meant to be disappointed in life, he was able to say in Romans 5, "And we boast in the hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, character hope, and hope does not disappoint." This is a different brand of hope altogether. How could he say that? Because he wasn't putting his hope in some sort of philosophical abstract idea or somebody's clever theory about life. He was putting his hope in a person who he had encountered. It's exactly what that beautiful passage that Joel read out in the Hebrews is talking about. This image of us fleeing to take hold of this hope that God has put before us so that we might be encouraged. We have this hope as an anchor for the soul, firm and secure. It enters the inner sanctuary behind the curtain where our forerunner Jesus has entered on our behalf. This idea of our hope is not flimsy, it's an anchor. It's heavy. And where is it, according to this passage? It has gone into the inner sanctuary behind the curtain. And who took it there? Jesus. This is like the idea of Jesus actually doing everything first. He's the forerunner. So he took our hope and he went forward to the end of time, the end of history, and he has dropped it there as an anchor. It's very similar to a maritime method of sailing called kedging. And Jared's going to help me out with this. So, before you do anything, Jared, kedging is actually this thing that sailors used to do when there was a big vessel, a big ship that was stranded, didn't have a motor or anything. It was this motorless big vessel stranded because of bad weather, right? And it was stuck. And what they would do to try to get the vessel moving again is that they would send out a little rowboat. And on the rowboat was the anchor of the ship. So they'd row the anchor out ahead of them to where they wanted the big vessel to end up going. And then the rowboat would drop the anchor, and the people on the big vessel would then get thrown a rope, row it. All right. And then they would pull themselves towards their destination, towards the anchor. Don't just keep it rigid. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Get the image right. Now, I saw that and was like, this is exactly what this passage is talking about. Okay? Jesus did everything first. He was resurrected first. He sat at the right hand of the Father, and he has gone ahead of us in time, to the end of all things. And there he has laid the anchor, our sure hope. And what he wants us to do as his people is to grab hold of the rope, the hope that he has sent our way. These are the sure, steadfast, certain promises of God. And all we have to do is grab hold of them. And then we pull ourselves closer to where Jesus is calling us to be, which is the end of all things, the fulfillment of everything that we hope for and long for. Does that make sense? So, what are these certain promises, these certain hopes? If you could just stand there for the rest of the sermon, that'd be great, Joe. That's all right. You could drop. What are these certain promises, these certain hopes that we can cling onto now as God's people? Because if we don't do it, then we'll get stuck. We'll get stuck in the past, stuck in the current moment. And Jesus wants us to move forward as the eschatological people. The first one we can grab hold of is Jesus will return. It's a bit of an obvious one, but you'd be surprised. A couple of years ago, I preached the sermon on the return of Jesus, and I thought for sure everyone would be like, in total agreement that this was going to happen. But a lady came up to me at the end of the sermon, and she was kind of adopting all these different beliefs. She was from another church, and she said that Jesus has already returned, because time is like a cycle. And if you think of it in that way, in a non-linear way, then Jesus has returned and he will return again. And I was thinking, no, if Jesus had returned, I would have seen it. Like, this is not some sort of cyclical thing or some subtle thing. Everywhere you read about it in the New Testament, it is absolutely 100% unmissable, right? And this is one of the things we can hold on to. We're talking about the re-entrance of the most powerful being in the universe into our reality, like ripping into our reality, and he will be here in a flash. John sees it in the end of the book of Revelation in chapter 19. He's been getting this like crazy heavenly glimpse of everything that will happen at the end of all things. And he's so overwhelmed by it that he falls to his knees in this scene at the end of Revelation. He falls to his knees and he starts worshiping an angel, because the angel's like been giving him this message. And the angel's like, whoa, don't worship me. Please don't do that. And then he goes, worship him. And then there is this crazy scene of the return of the king, the return of Jesus. And it's all crazy metaphorical language, but it's meant to say Jesus is unmissable. It says, I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse, whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and wages war. His eyes are like blazing fire, and on his head are many crowns. He has a name written on him that no one knows but he himself. He is dressed in a robe dipped in blood, and his name is the Word of God. That's the blood of his sacrifice. The armies of heaven were following him, riding on white horses and dressed in fine linen, white and clean. Coming out of his mouth is a sharp sword with which to strike down the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter. He treads the winepress of the fury of the wrath of God Almighty. On his robe and on his thigh, he has this name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Like, this image is no small thing. This should haunt you. It should haunt every person on the planet, because it's terrifying. But for the people of God, it is hauntingly awesome. Hauntingly awesome. This is going to happen. And it should get us on our tiptoes, eager with every breath that we breathe to see this. Right? It's amazing. This is the moment that every knee will bow and tongue confess finally that Jesus is Lord. He has been Lord this whole time. He is the King. And it means a lot of things for us, right? When we grab hold to this certain promise, it means that everything that you see going on in the world at the moment won't drag on. It feels like it's dragging on, but it won't. It's not like a symphony that never ends or just an overlong film. It's going to wrap up. And Jesus is going to be the one who will wrap it up. And it could happen at any moment. Any moment. And that's a crazy thing to think about. When you think about it, time is actually on a complete forward motion. Everything is going forward. History is going forward. It started with the creation of the universe, and since then it's just going full throttle. And philosophers and scientists are always working out why that is. They're trying to work it out, why that is. But this is why. It's heading towards this conclusion, to the return of Jesus. And that should keep us in a state of urgency, to know and believe that he's about to come. It should fan the flame of your faith. It should cause us to be desperate in everything that we do for Jesus, not out of a fear, but out of just a joyful, hauntingly awesome excitement to witness, to work on our character through the power of the Spirit, to know that we're actually blessed enough to be in the final act of history. And we don't have a script before us, we just have the Spirit and what the faithfulness of God has shown us in the past. And we just keep going, keep holding on to this sure foundation until Jesus returns. The second thing that we need to hold on to as God's people and cling on to, particularly when things get tough in life, is that there will be glory. Paul talks about this one thing that's coming. Whenever he's thinking about the end, he always uses this word, glory. There will be glory. He speaks about it in Romans 8 when he says, famously, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. In 2 Corinthians, he says, therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we're wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. There's a lot of debates about what that glory is, but it's probably two things. First thing is, it's the glory of a resurrected body. That was so important to Paul. That means that, yes, there's life after death. We know that Christians believe that, but it's not like reincarnation, and it's not you coming back as an animal or something, and it's not you kind of becoming one with the universe. It is you, after you die, coming back to life, still you, but clothed with an infinite, eternal body, an imperishable body. So it's like you, but better, pretty much, which sounds nice. It sounds very nice. But it's real. It's a body. That's the Jewish tradition, and Christianity follows in that sure hope. It's bodily. You will continue. That was so important to Paul because he talks about glory whenever he's also talking about suffering, and he knew what it meant to suffer. He knew what it meant to physically endure so much trauma and hardship and psychological trauma. And that's when he always talks about the hope of the glory of the resurrected body. Every disease gone. Every sickness gone. No more sorrow. No more pain. If you want to think about what that might look like, you look at Jesus' resurrected body as a type of that, what that resurrected body might look like. But there's another way to think about glory as well. Quite a few years ago now, I preached one of my first sermons at Morling College. And I had to preach it in front of somebody who I just admired so much, right? Who may or may not have preached this morning at our church. And I wanted to do like the best job possible. Like I wanted to perfect this thing. Absolutely, right? And then the day came and I preached it in front of him and it went super well. It went really, really well. Like exceptionally blew my mind kind of well. And it was like fireworks just erupting in my insides in absolute joy. It was like the pinnacle moment for me because this person who I admired was praising me. He was validating me. He was accepting me and affirming me. And every person is wired for that. There's a lot of sin wrapped up in it and pride, but we're wired for that. To seek praise from the one who we most adore and admire. But a year after that incredible mountaintop experience, I met up with this person for coffee, and we were talking about sermons, and he said to me, I've never heard you preach. Never heard you preach. Have you preached before? And I didn't say anything, but on the inside, it shattered me, right? Because I had put so much stake in what this person thought of me. I desired praise. I desired to be known. But, you know, we all have that kind of issue in seeking praise from other people. But a day is coming when you will actually be in the presence of the being, the person, the one, the God who you are designed to crave affection from. And he will look at you and he will either praise you, which will be like fireworks in your soul times of infinity, or he will shame you. And that will be horrific. C.S. Lewis can say it way better than me. In his essay, The Weight of Glory, he says, in the end, that face, which is the delight or the terror of the universe, must be turned upon each of us, either with one expression or with the other, either conferring glory inexpressible or inflicting shame that can never be cured or disguised. But to please God, to be a real ingredient in the divine happiness, to be loved by God, not merely pitied by him, but delighted in, as an artist delights in his work or a father in a son, it seems impossible, a weight or burden of glory which our thoughts can hardly sustain. But so it is. So it will be. That day is coming. I can't wait for it. And you know what? When I grab hold of that truth now that there will be glory, that means I don't put as much weight in what other people think about me. Because the only opinion that truly matters is that of God. And that is just freedom. To not be dictated to by the fear of man or crippled by that anxiety. That's what it means to grab hold of that certain anchor for our soul. It also gives us hope in the darkest moments, because somehow Paul could say that thinking about the resurrected body and the glory of just being loved by God, he could say that in the worst pain, the worst sickness imaginable, the bone-aching loss that he experienced and the sickness, when everything in his life had collapsed, he could say that in comparison to what's coming, it is only light and momentary. Light as in like a feather. It's just like eternity's coming. This is just like, what is the worst pain is a feather, and it's momentary. It's a microsecond. When you compare it to infinite time with God, he said that over and over again. No other worldview can give you that. No other worldview can give you that. No worldview or world religion can give you this hope, because they can't conceive of something so great, because they've come up with it and they're humans. Their hopes are plastic. Their hopes are plastic. Hinduism says you deserve your suffering. Buddhism says you'll get what you are owed. Nihilism says there is no meaning whatsoever in your suffering, and therefore no hope. But Jesus, who's already there at the end of time, waiting to give it to us, says, grab hold of this. It's reality. Finally, the third hope we can grab hold of is that everything will be renewed. This is a hard one to put into words, so I'm just going to show you a painting. This is a painting by a guy called John Martin. It's part of a trio of paintings he painted about the end. The other two are really scary, but this is the nice one. It's called The Plains of Heaven. And I don't know if you can see it in heaps of detail, but as soon as I saw this, it kind of like tugged on the deepest longings in me. Because I know deep down that I'm wired to be there. This is the new heavens and the new earth. You can see there the heavenly Jerusalem in like the fog. But it's not just about the heavenly Jerusalem where God is one day going to come and dwell with his people forever and ever. There's like, it's the new creation. It's this earth. Literally what we're standing on right now. Renewed, resurrected. And it's, I love that how this painting captures the infinite nature of what God's new creation is going to be like. Just listen to some of these words in Revelation. And look at the painting. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He'll wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne, as Jesus saying, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." That's what's coming. In the end, Jesus won't just do away with everything. He's the God of resurrection. He will renew all things. And that has so much gravity for us as God's eschatological people. It means that we need to take care of this earth that we live in, not just because it's a good, popular thing to do, to steward the environment, but because this world will continue. It will be renewed and made better, just like we will be, but this earth will continue. So right now, we steward it because we're going to be stewarding it with God as co-heirs with God for all of eternity. So we're training to reign with God. That's what it means to take care of this world. It also means trusting in Jesus' power to renew all things. When he came the first time, he healed people. He healed them physically and emotionally and spiritually. He ushered in transformation because he's the God of renewal. And that's what he's going to do at the end, only for the entire universe. And somehow he uses us in his grace to be agents of renewal as well through the power of the Spirit, to take part in God's gradual renewal of all things. We know that the future is coming because Jesus has gone into it first. He has gone ahead of us and he has dropped the anchor and he just wants us to grab hold of these certainties and not get stuck, but to move with him, to look past the now into the horizon. Jesus promised he will return, so it will be. Jesus was glorified when he was resurrected first and sat at the right hand of the Father, and we will get to experience glory because of that. And Jesus showed his power to renew everything, and one day we'll see it unfold before our eyes. So as we take communion together, I just want you to get your wafer and your juice and rip off the film. We know this is more than a meal. This is a sacred space. But it's also more than that. We sang in the first song, one of the first songs, Ancient Gates, the one who was, the one who is, and the one who is to come. And this meal that Jesus gave us taps into the reality of all those three things. We take the bread, which is a symbol of his body broken for us. And we take the juice, which represents his blood poured out for us. And we think about the past, what Jesus did on the cross, his death and resurrection. It happened 2,000 years ago, but somehow right now in this meal, we are living it. He's the one who was, who saved us. But he's also the one who is. His presence is right here in this moment. And he sees you. He sees your heart. He sees when you've been just drowned by disappointment in life and sometimes carried on into despair, moments of despair. He sees you and he calls us to remember what he's done for us, that he set us free, and to remember that we are the people of hope. He's the one who was, the one who is, and he is the one who is to come. We take this meal, and somehow, beautifully, it is a signpost pointing us to the final feast that we'll have together as God's people in the new heavens and the new earth. So when we take it, we take the bread, we take the drink, we think of what's happened in the past, the one who was. We think of Jesus right now with us, the one who is. And we think of the hope that we have, the certain hope we have in the future, the one who is to come. And we take this and we proclaim Jesus' death until he returns again. So I just give you one moment to hold those elements, hold the bread, hold the juice. And perhaps God's saying to you right now through his Spirit, my hope is real. My hope is true. I died so that you could have it. I will come again. There will be glory for you. And I'll make all things new. Let's take a moment and let the Spirit of God allow that to become a reality. Stand. It's his body that is broken for us. Let's eat together. This is his blood, the blood of the eternal covenant. A symbol of what he's done in the past, what he's doing now in our lives, and what he will do at the end of all things. Let's drink this as God's eschatological people. Amen. God, we lift you up. Jesus, we praise your name. Thank you, Lord, that you went before us. Thank you that you dropped the anchor of our hope. And Lord, all we need to do now is to hold fast the certainties of your promises. So God, as your people right now, we lift up your name. We worship you like we will worship you in glory. And we make much of you, Lord, as the Lord of our lives. Amen.